It's kind of like a bad movie trailer. Can one man's choice change the course of the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 20th of December. Good to have you with us. That one man is, of course, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. His weekend bombshell that he will not be voting for President Biden's Build Back Better social spending bill has had some ripple effects. Goldman Sachs downgraded its forecast for economic growth next year from 3% in the first quarter to just 2%. Now, it's anybody's guess what happens with the legislation and its larger goals. We'll leave the politics to other outlets. But one reason Manchin gave for his decision was also economic. He says the infusion of government spending would make inflation, already running at close to 7%, even worse. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher looked into the connection.
Economics professors sometimes teach about inflation using the visual of a bathtub. If money pours into the economy faster than it can drain, it will spill over. But Leah Downey at the Sheffield Political Economy Research Institute prefers a flowerbed analogy.
If you pour a lot of water on the bits that are already saturated, then it's going to overflow.
Downey says high spending does not necessarily lead to inflation.
It depends on how you spend and what you spend on and when you spend.
She says programs like early childhood education might cost a lot up front, but are designed to reap benefits down the road. Bill Dupour with the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis researched government spending from the 1960s to 2005.
So when government spending increases rapidly, for example, for defense spending, we don't see inflation go up by very much at all.
That's true for other government programs, too. But Chris Sims, professor emeritus at Princeton, says short-term spending is different. Take those stimulus checks, meant to keep people afloat and prevent deep recession.
And it succeeded in that. We're getting a little bit of an overshoot.
That increase in consumer demand affected supply, which affected prices. Kent Smetters is a professor at the Wharton School. He says low-income families tend to spend more on necessities that are more expensive now, like groceries, heat, and gas.
And so more fiscal stimulus that targets lower-income households will tend to have more impact on inflation going forward.
But he also points out that supply chain constraints and labor shortages are contributing too. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
Sticking with government spending a little longer, the apparent demise of Build Back Better also throws into question how the United States will meet its climate goals. Baked into the spending bill was more than $550 billion aimed at slowing global warming. There were tax credits for installing solar panels and buying electric vehicles, and financial incentives for clean energy technologies. So where does that leave plans to cut U.S. emissions? Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
The possibility of this bill not getting through the Senate has some very clever folks searching for the right words. That's Jason Bordoff, co-founding dean of Columbia University's Climate School.
If Build Back Better fails in its entirety, it is very hard to see how the United States achieves the climate goals that the Biden administration pledged we would achieve by 2030 without this legislation. It's the centerpiece.
Biden's 2030 goals included a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by half of what they were in 2005 and net zero by 2050, all to help ensure global warming slows down. Leah Stokes teaches environmental studies at UC Santa Barbara.
We don't really have a plan without the Build Back Better Act to stop the warming.
She says cities and state governments can help reduce emissions, but this really has to happen on a larger scale. Kelly Sanders is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Southern California.
Our challenge is really that we need to go faster, and faster is really going to be hard to do without a big federal push.
And a big federal budget. That was a major part of Senator Joe Manchin's problem with the bill. He said it would just add more debt. Rachel Cletus at the Union of Concerned Scientists says she hopes this wasn't a lost opportunity for private industry, too.
You can see so many businesses wanting to jump in with both feet. And instead, we have Congress continuing to delay action instead of putting the interests of our people and our economy first.
She's optimistic that at least some part of the bill will survive. Without it, she says it's hard for the U.S. to claim to be a leader in climate mitigation policy to the rest of the world. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, not a lot of optimism. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Going back to that downgraded forecast from Goldman Sachs, it's the time of year when analysts look back on the economic year gone by and start predicting what we might expect in the coming year. And congressional action or inaction is just one of the many moving parts to consider. Wendy Edelberg is the director of the Hamilton Project at the Brookings Institution. We gave her a call to talk about economic forecasting in uncertain times. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Can you walk me through the thinking behind this Goldman Sachs forecast that basically projects a lot slower growth if this Build Back Better plan doesn't pass?
So they have knocked down their GDP forecast for next year by about a half a percentage point. But let me put that in some context. Keeping in place the full refundability of the child tax credit that's in Build Back Better would be a game changer for millions of people. Whether GDP grows 4% or 3.5% is not a game changer, particularly in light of all the forces that are buffeting the economy right now, which could lead to very different GDP numbers.
So that speaks to sort of the difficulty in forecasting right now. There are so many variables, not least of which is the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. What are forecasters to do?
Yeah, so I am particularly focused on what margins are holding the economy back right now. So real spending on consumer services is still 1.5% below its pre-pandemic level. The labor force is still over 2 million shy of where it would be if participation were at an adequately healthy level. For retail goods, the amount of inventory relative to sales is at its lowest level since we started to measure the ratio. So improvements on these margins are really going to be much more affected by the pandemic than anything like what's happening to fiscal support over the next year.
And given how little we know about where the pandemic is headed, how does that make the job of a forecaster more challenging?
Oh, indeed. It is all about the pandemic, and I have been repeatedly wrong. So I am certainly humbled. So, for example, thinking about how Omicron is going to affect the recovery, we still have blazing hot demand in the goods sector. I don't even know where we're putting all of these goods that we're buying. I don't understand how we still have storage space. It's a big unknown to me whether that means that we continue to gorge ourselves on goods or we actually finally bring down our goods spending and just overall increase our savings. Everything's unknown right now.
That said, we do have a whole slew of indicators coming out this week, a pre-holiday data dump, including home sales, revised third quarter GDP. What are you going to be watching?
I will be watching closely to see what happens to inventories. We need to see manufacturers be able to rebuild inventories. That's going to be a big source of economic growth going forward. And obviously, anything that we can continue to learn about what's happening to the services sector is going to be really important. The longer our services sector stays distressed, the more likely we're to have long-term scarring in that sector, both among the firms in that sector and people who used to work in this sector. The longer they remain unemployed or out of the labor force, the harder it is going to be to bring them back in and get them working in productive jobs.
Now, this is the time of year when there are a lot of forecasts coming out for the next year. Given what you said, I mean, you admitted you yourself have been wrong several times, and I applaud you for being honest about that. Are these forecasts still useful if they're so prone to being wrong?
They're useful in that they tell us this is the best we know with the information we have now. So when you see people's forecasts, what it's really indicating is this is what they think they see as the challenges in the economy now and where they see the mismatches and where they see things out of equilibrium.
All right, Wendy Edelberg with the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
For decades, indigenous farmers and ranchers argued that the U.S. Department of Agriculture's loan programs discriminated against them. In 1999, they filed a class action lawsuit, and after nearly 20 years of legal wrangling, they reached a settlement that established the Native American Agriculture Fund. That was in 2018. Now that group is setting up its own financial institution to improve Native producers' access to credit. Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports.
Before that settlement, Lyman Cauliflower was looking to expand his family's cattle ranch on the Rocky Boy Reservation in Montana. He says securing loans from local banks was pretty simple, but
the process with the FSA and that part really wasn't.
The FSA is the Federal Farm Service Agency. Cauliflower believes that it saw him as a risky investment, since, like many Native producers, he works on tribal land that he doesn't own outright.
You can't use that as collateral. That's probably the toughest barrier for Indian ranchers.
Ranchers like Ruben Roman, who raises cattle on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. He says the process is still frustrating.
I got denied every which way.
So he skipped the federal process and went to a Native-owned bank in South Dakota.
We got the loans and I bought some cattle like that. They do all my lending now.
These stories are common among Native producers, says Carly Hotvet with the Indigenous Food and Agriculture Coalition. Instead of traditional banks and the federal government, she says tribally owned community development financial institutions, or CDFIs, can fill producers' needs.
They are specifically targeted towards supporting Indigenous producers that other institutions may not be as willing to extend credit for.
The Native American Agriculture Fund's new financial institution will support those community banks. CEO Tony Stanger McLaughlin says the goal is to increase the amount they have to lend to Native producers.
To allow them the ability to grow, to have the same opportunities that were provided to other farmers.
Stanger says it's still up to the federal government to improve its lending process for Native farmers. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I literally rip off like Superman.
Those button-down shirts can feel a bit stuffy, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 433 points, 1.2%, to finish at 34,932. The NASDAQ dropped 188 points, also 1.2%, to end at 14,980. And the S&P 500 dipped 52 points, 1.1%, to land at 4568. We talked about Goldman Sachs lowering its projections for GDP in light of the Build Back Better news. Goldman Sachs fell 2.6%. Looking at other investment banks, Morgan Stanley lost 1.8%. JPMorgan Chase was down 1.7%. Auction house Sotheby's says that 2021 has been its most lucrative year ever after 277 years in business. It sold a record $7.3 billion worth of art. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.42%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know.
Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's been close to 2 years now since most people with federal student loans have had to make any payments. In March of 2020, as part of its pandemic response, the federal government put those payments on pause, along with the interest that accrues on those loans. But at the end of January, both the interest and the payments are set to come back. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that story.
3 months into the pandemic, Christopher Gagne got laid off from his job as an acupuncturist at a hospital in Connecticut. Not having to keep paying his student loans while he was unemployed, he says, was huge.
Because I was able to, you know, kind of maintain my head above water for the course of the pandemic.
Gagne is 59, and he still owes almost $143,000 in student loans, even though he's been paying them since 2000.
I feel like I've had a millstone around my neck for the past 20 years.
The interest rate on his loans is over 8%, so even though he's been paying hundreds of dollars a month, his balance has grown. When that interest stopped accruing during the pandemic, he says, it was a game changer.
I was able to do things like, you know, maintain my car and pay my rent and not see my savings account get drained. And, you know, I was still able to put some money towards my retirement.
More than 40 million people around the country have federal student loans that have been on pause since the pandemic began.
A lot of them use this as an opportunity to continue paying things that were essential in their budgets.
Sarah Foster is an analyst at Bankrate. She says in a recent survey her company did with the website Best Colleges, 40% of borrowers said they used money they otherwise would have put towards student loans to pay for groceries, utilities, and other everyday expenses. And 30% used it to pay down credit cards, medical bills, and other debt. Betsy Mayotte at the Institute of Student Loan Advisors said she's also heard from a lot of people who were able to build up emergency savings, some for the first time.
And then I've seen borrowers who have taken advantage of the 0% interest rate and have been throwing every penny they can at their student loans to reduce the principal or outright pay them off.
The fact that people's loans weren't accruing interest at 4, 6, or 8%, Mayotte says, was maybe even more significant than the payment pause. It meant people's balances weren't growing while they weren't paying, and it gave people who could afford to make payments a chance to really make a dent in their loan balances.
What I was hearing from borrowers was, listen, the interest rate doesn't make me feel like I'm on a level playing field, and having the 0% interest at least made me feel like I was on a level playing field.
When interest and payments start again at the end of January, 75% of people with federal loans, according to Bankrate, say it's going to have a negative impact on them financially, including 24-year-old Krista Pekacek.
That's another like $300 to $500 a month out of my paycheck that I can't spare.
Pekacek works full-time as an administrative assistant at a K-12 school in Seattle. She says it's an improvement over the way she spent much of the pandemic, working unpredictable hours as a baker.
While I am still in a better place financially than I was like 6 months ago, I still have a lot of medical bills. So I'm not feeling great about student loan payments coming back.
Not having to make those payments, she says, allowed her to move out of her parents' house, pay off some of her medical bills, and stop using her credit card so much.
I've become much, much more independent without having to pay that every month.
Knowing that she's going to lose that wiggle room soon, Pekacek says, fills her with dread. Christopher Gagne isn't looking forward to his loan payments resuming either. But he says at least it's happening now rather than a few months ago.
I feel like I've got a solid situation to kind of face this.
After a year and a half of being unemployed and underemployed, this month he finally found a new full-time job with a better salary.
It's perfect timing, just in time to pay my student loan.
And he has a bit more in savings now than he did before. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
For many of the millions of former office workers who went remote during the pandemic, plans to go back have been postponed and postponed again, delayed by Delta, now by Omicron, and who knows what comes next. And that means what once seemed like a temporary work uniform is looking like a permanent change. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on the staying power of sweats.
In the early days of the pandemic, the second week of April 2020 to be exact, a bold headline from the Los Angeles Times made millions of readers sit up on their sofas.
Enough with the work-from-home sweatpants, dress like the adult you're getting paid to be.
Adam Shorn is the features writer at the LA Times responsible for that column, in which he admonished wearers of cozy athleisure to grow up and show some respect by constraining their bodies with cold, hard pants and buttons. The internet got very mad.
I don't think I read the room quite right.
Not really. As we struggled through the trauma of a century, why would we possibly care about maintaining business casual? Frankly, I was team sweatpants for life. And sweatpants still feel comfortable, but there are other ways I used to feel in those old days of dressing for work that I kind of miss.
You're physically wearing the clothes so you can feel that tactile experience and be the symbolic associations you have with those clothes.
Adam Galinsky is a social psychologist at Columbia Business School who researches enclothed cognition, how what we wear affects how we think.
It doesn't just affect other people's impressions of us. It also affects our own sort of psychological orientations and processes.
During the pandemic, Galinsky found that though traditional work clothing made some people feel more powerful, what he calls home clothing made them feel authentic, which made them more engaged in their work. Samuel Chu has found this. He's a community organizer in Los Angeles who works with NGOs on human rights campaigns.
I literally just have lived in my activewear for the last 2 years.
Well, except for those times he has to give remote testimony to Congress and stuff.
I do like put on a shirt and a jacket, but that's it. Like only the top, I testify. And like the moment that the Zoom ends, like I am back. Like I literally rip off like Superman and back to my sweatpants.
To Chu, sweats are symbolic of how the pandemic has blurred the distinction between our home and our work lives. But without the compelled routine of office clothing, workdays can too easily merge into nights, time and to-do lists, stretching like so much flexible knitwear.
So I feel like what you're hinting at is boundaries.
Jill Duffy is the author of The Everything Guide to Remote Work. She's tried it all, dressing up, dressing down, and says both have their merits.
There are lots of things we do to ritualize the beginning of the day and the end of the day. And it doesn't have to be about getting dressed or taking a shower or putting on makeup.
For her, that means having one designated work chair, a lamp she turns on and off at specific times, and headphones she puts on to focus. For Adam Shorn at the LA Times, it means putting on a collared shirt, Levi's, and sneakers. But that's just him.
If I knew then what I knew now, I'd say, good God, wear whatever you want. We need to get through this.
Me? I'm considering investing in some clothes I don't also want to sleep in. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
I dressed up to host the show today. I'm wearing my good sweats. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the roller coaster that has been 2021. Take the Marketplace year-end poll at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, remember Davos, the Swiss resort town where the world's business tycoons and economic leaders gather to schmooze and strategize each January? or used to anyway. For the second year in a row, the World Economic Forum is postponing the gathering until summer, this time because of continued uncertainty about the Omicron variant. The 2021 meeting was initially postponed to May and then August and then eventually scrapped altogether. For 2022, the WEF now plans a series of virtual sessions next month to discuss global challenges and try for an in-person gathering in early summer, which, given the past couple weeks, months, years, seems optimistic. All right, we are out of here, but first your moment of economic context. We'll get an update on the housing market later this week when November sales numbers for both new and existing homes come out. But here's a sobering item from the real estate brokerage Redfin, which says the number of houses on the market reached an all-time low in November. If there's a hint of hope in there for would-be home buyers, houses were a bit less likely to sell for more than the asking price. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.